WWRL.
You found it. The most exciting afternoon talk in New York.
And I'm looking forward to people bringing ideas forward.
This is Drive Time Dialogue with Sam Greenfield and Armstrong Williams.
It is 4:06, Armstrong Williams and Sam Greenfield at 1600 AM WWRL. We'll be with you till 6 o'clock. Our phone number for chat, for dialogue, is 212-868-0975. Grant Smith is our guest, research director for the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. We're talking about the Gaza pullout, which will take place in full this week. Many are leaving without protest. Some have locked the gates of their communities, formed human chains, burned tires to block Israeli soldiers. This, as police and soldiers are waiting patiently and avoiding confrontations for now. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said today that the pullout is a painful step, but essential for Israel's future. Armstrong, take it away.
Now, welcome to the show. Obviously, you're in 100% support of the Israelis leaving Gaza.
Absolutely, Armstrong. I think...
No. I just wanted a yes and no.
Okay.
So, correct me if I'm wrong. But your organization believes that Israel should return to the sides of its 1967 borders.
Absolutely.
Even though prior to 1967, Palestine was controlled by Great Britain, and the land was divided into Jordan and Israel, Jordan was designated as the land for the Palestinians, and all the land to the west of Jordan River was Israel for the Jews. Let's not forget, the only reason that Israel controls the Gaza Strip in the West Bank is because she was attacked by Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, and confiscated the lands as spoils of the war.
You've got two major misconceptions there, Armstrong. First of all, we have approximately 4.3 million refugees who either fled or left directly as a result of the 1948 creation of Israel. And if we talk about the myth of the 1967 Six-Day War, we heard last year from the Office of the Historian at the U.S. State Department that the Egyptians were actively trying to wind down the confrontation and even received guarantees by Nasser that Egypt would not strike. And nevertheless, we have a preemptive Israeli strike on June 6th of 1967, which resulted in all of this territory being captured. You've got two fundamental misconceptions, Armstrong. Number one, that the people occupying that region had no right to continue occupying that region. And number two, that the 67 war was a heroic attempt to respond to a military threat. We know now that that military threat was winding down and that the true aggressor certainly was not Egypt.
What are you trying to say, that the 1967 war was Israel's fault?
What we can say is this, with
that's
a great
what you're
deal
saying.
Of confidence, the Israelis are thought by the U.S. to have intercepted and then thwarted the Egyptian entreaties because during that time, the Egyptians were actively working with the United States trying to wind down the conflict. You can say that the June 6, 1967 strikes were preemptive, but they were preempting an event which was rapidly going to wind down if they hadn't struck.
Sam, this is a doozy. I'm going to let you handle this.
I've heard that for years.
I am shocked.
I've heard that for years,
so
that it was a preemptive strike.
Send you the...
The first strike was launched by Israel as a preemptive strike. Yes, of course.
We really need to deal in facts and not mythology.
Egypt attack, Syria attack, Jordan attack. What are you talking about?
The first shots were fired by Israel, and they said it all along. It was a preemptive strike because they feared attack.
You know, part of the mythology that we're actively dealing with here is... a mythology about suicide terrorism that we also need to confront with facts. Robert Pape, who just wrote a book called Dying to Win, looked at analytically all of the suicide terror attacks from 1980 to 2003 and concluded one central fact about suicide terrorism. It's a strategic effort to compel target governments to withdraw forces from land that the so-called terrorists perceive as their national homeland. We can say that this is a productive minor step in abating terrorism by simply disoccupying a section considered legitimately by many Palestinians to be their land.
Look, so most of the... I'm sorry, Sam.
No, go ahead, please.
You know, most of the Palestinians are refugees. They're not allowed back in Jordan. They're not allowed back in Syria. They're not allowed back in Egypt, so they are living in Israel. Israel is the only Jewish country in the Middle East, but 99% of the Middle East is Arabs.
What's your point?
The point is they can't even go back to their own Arab lands and live. They don't want them back there. And let's not forget what the Egyptians did to them.
As I just said, there are 4.3 million refugees who either fled or were expulsed or left from territory that we now call Israel. Are you dealing with that fact? I mean, let's look at this. This is a really minor step towards peace in the Middle East. If we look at what experts say in an IRMEP.org poll of university professors, Middle East experts, we found that 96% of professors who are experts in the Middle East believe the U.S. don't have any authority to legitimize its Israeli annexation of West Bank territory, East Jerusalem, or anything outside of 1967 borders. We have this myth about the 1967 war, which in 2004, again, the Office of the Historian of the U.S. State Department talked about. We have this study of suicide terrorism. We have continued provocations by the Israeli Housing Ministry saying that it's going to expand settlements. We're focusing on Gaza, but what we should really be focusing on right now, Armstrong, is the encirclement of East Jerusalem, the creation of more settlements in Maale Adumim and other West Bank settlements that are continuing to provoke conflict. I mean, the U.S. can resume walking in the high moral ground in the Middle East only after it ensures a complete Israeli withdrawal from all land captured in 1967. Anything less, it's going to continue to threaten American interests in the region.
But then what do you suggest in how we as Americans should handle Israel?
We need to take a look at one thing that is not looked at usually by the press or any analysis, and that's the $60 billion, a large portion of which is flowing completely off the books from the United States, from nonprofits.
Before we get there, I want to ask you a question.
And build settlements in the West
Grant,
Bank.
Grant, yes. Before we get there, I want to ask you a question. Weren't there an equal number of Jews expelled from Iraq and Egypt during that time?
Relatively small numbers. I heard 800 in the case of Iraq.
And how about Egypt?
In places like Morocco and others, they continue along the lines of a very tolerant attitude toward their Jewish population.
But how about the countries that are bordering or close to Israel? How's their expulsion rate?
I think what we need to talk about, and this is, you're getting into the homeland issue, is whether some of the initial reasons for forming the state as a way to combat anti-Semitism and terrific problems faced by Jews in various countries. A number of analysts, Jewish analysts, have said quite clearly that those conditions are no longer in action, and that we really need to think about whether this whole analysis of expulsion and populations moving around and anti-Semitism is still relevant enough to be paying these costs.
So are you saying that Israel should be dissolved?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'm not saying that.
Okay, so back to the point of how should America handle, we Americans, how should we handle Israel?
Well, we need to really, I think it's best expressed this way, we need to begin treating this country like other countries. We need to negotiate with it. We need to make clear that we have certain policy goals that are embedded in international law. We need to talk about UN resolutions and why there isn't any compliance, and we need to shut down the flows that are able to get this $60 billion of off-the-books expenditures that are flowing into Israel to create settlements. We need to turn that spigot off, because that's only creating problems. It's only going to create more terrorism, as we've seen from the papers.
Why is aid to Israel? Are you saying if there was no aid to Israel, the terrorism would stop?
No, I'm not talking about the $3 billion that we spend for defending the country and certain other expenditures. I'm talking about all of the rest of the expenditures that are flowing. Let's take a look at Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who's now under so much scrutiny. He had taken money from Indian gaming tribes, passed it to the Capital Athletic Foundation to buy arms, sniper scopes, and other equipment for settlers in the West Bank. That's the kind of thing that's causing terrorism. That's the kind of thing that's provoking conflict in the region. And that's the kind of thing that we're not looking at as Americans. We need to shut off that type of activity. Abramoff might have been caught. His little use of nonprofits to fund conflict might have finally been disclosed, but there's an immense universe of that type of activity taking place, which the U.S. is unwilling to confront.
You know what? I'm not in total disagreement with you about the money, okay? nonprofit aid, though. How do you shut that off?
Well, I think you need to regulate it so that if there is going to be any aid to the country, that it's flowing to legitimate projects in the country, and that it's not earmarked to displace or create fungible transactions that will generate conflict. We need to monitor it. We need to publish data. We need to start questioning what money is going for. We need to control it. We need to look at if this is a privileged tax-exempt transaction that's done to provide money for activity. We need to make sure that it's actually going toward that. That could be added IRS disclosure. That could be more control and more involvement of the U.S. State Department. It could be more involvement from the Treasury Department, which is so active in tracking terrorist financing, but not looking at this type of issue at all.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What is the roadmap to peace, if there's any? Because the picture you paint sounds very bleak.
Well, it's not bleak. I think when we finally get back to an actual roadmap discussion and involvement of all of the players instead of a series of unilateral moves by each side, with most taking place on the Israeli side, we see that there is actually a plan for disengagement, for economic development. There are many studies circulating right now talking about the next steps in the roadmap for economic development and injecting funds so that the airport can be opened in the Gaza Strip, so that people can begin. And I know you mentioned the case of agriculture and greenhouses, so that people can begin having a viable economic future. Those are steps which have to take place in concert. You can't have, obviously, a functioning airport in Gaza if the Israelis feel threatened and if there are security issues outstanding. These are all steps, however, which are delayed, which will be set back if we continue to have settlement expansion, if we continue to ship money, arms, etc., and other under-the-table payments into occupation and colonization, which will only create added resentment.
There's another part of this, and the other part that we don't talk about because it's been such a constant is the fanaticism. How does the fanaticism become quelled? How does the fact that Gaza is now going to be in the hands of the Palestinians, and part of the celebration is burning an Israeli flag, and Hamas announcing that they're not going to stop or lessen their terrorist activities. Given that, what kind of hope is there for a long-range future?
Well, that fanaticism, we believe, is going to die down because it is driven by the occupation.
Oh, really?
And really, if you believe that that type of fanaticism will continue even after incremental transfers of territory, which again are the biggest driver of their terrorist activities, will continue, it won't, because it will be completely debased. It will be undercut by the fact that they have actually not succeeded in via terrorism, but succeeded in dampening and quelling some of the motivations for an occupied people to strike back with the only thing that they have.
Do you agree with Michael Sam Greenfield that once the Israelis lead the land the Israelis once had, that will fall to the level of the other land the Palestinians own?
In what regard?
We need
economics.
We need to look at whether or not the Palestinians will be allowed to actually access any of the resources that they'll need for economic development. I mean, one of the great success stories is the installation of a Coca-Cola bottling plant so that there could actually be jobs and distribution of our signature product here in the United States and actually have a little bit of wealth development. But if the private sector can't get in, can't put in infrastructure, if the Palestinians can't tap any international capital, they're certainly not going to get $60 billion of off-the-books money. But if they can't even get 10 or 20 per year, on a regular basis for economic development, if they're essentially put in a cage of discontiguous parcels, well, maybe it will descend into chaos, but it'll have a reason for descending into chaos. If there is no capital flow into the region, it has a bleak future.
Listen, we want to thank you for your time, Grant. Grant Smith, Research Director, Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, talking about the Gaza pullout. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
And I must say, there is some merit to some of the things that you were saying. Some of them. I have to admit that I'd be the first to admit. Drive Time Dialogue, Sam Greenfield and Armstrong Williams. It is exactly 24 minutes after the hour of 4. We're coming back to your phone calls at 212-868-0975. We'll be back.
WWRL covers the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut area at 1600 AM and the world at www.